Good afternoon. We'll start this informal hearing on case number PU-23-086. It's an Otter Tail Power case regarding the Langdon Wind Energy Center upgrade. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Sherry Haugen-Hoffert and Julie Fedorchek. So we are all here. We'll have staff and the company go around and introduce themselves for the record. I do want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, so it will only be dealing with information that is not in dispute. If anything comes up that is in dispute, we will adjourn the informal and convene a formal hearing at another time. I didn't have any opening comments other than to apologize. It's on my calendar correctly. I was just thinking of 1:30, and thanks, Brian, for not making me any later than I already am. Commissioner Haugen-Hoffert, did you have any opening comments?
No, I don't.
Did you forget yet?
I don't
have opening comments.
Okay. Let's go around the room and get everybody's name on the record, please.
Brian Johnson, PFC staff. PSC staff.
Victor Shook with staff.
Molly Smith with Fredrickson and Byron on behalf of Otter Tail Power Company.
I'm Bryce Haugen on behalf of Otter Tail Power Company.
Hi, Lisa McFarland, Otter Tail Power Company.
And Randy Sinstelen with Otter Tail Power Company.
How do you spell your last name?
S-Y-N-S-T-E. L-I-E-N, a good Norwegian name, Sinstelien.
It is a good name, but your first name is even more awesome. So, do you have people online?
We do have two individuals online as well.
And go ahead and give us your name, whoever's online.
I could introduce them and hope that they show up.
Sorry. This is Jason Utton from Atwell. Thanks a lot for the time today, Commissioners.
And Jason, what's your last name?
It's Utton, sir. It's spelled U as in uniform, T-T-O-N.
Yep, and you're on the screen now.
Okay.
And Harvey?
Yeah, Harvey McMahon with Otter Tail, and I'm the manager of Development, Engineering, and Construction.
Okay, we'll turn it over to the company. Usually goes first in informal hearings, but it looks like Commissioner Fedorchek had something.
I do have just one thing. I have a hard stop at 2, so hopefully we'll be able to get a bulk of it done. But if I slip off, and it is technically my portfolio, so I'll have to pass it over to you guys if I have to be done at 2. So if we're not done by then, but feel free to carry on. I think that's why we started at 1. Because of the 2 o'clock that I have. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having us here for this hearing to discuss the Langdon facility repower. If it's okay with the commissioners, go through the slide deck. We'll provide a little overview of the slide deck and then we'll go through it. Today, the project before us is to talk through Otter Tail's ask for the certification and amendment request for this work at Langdon. And also we'll talk about the work to be done at the existing 27 turbines at the 40.5 megawatt facility, the work to be done in Q3 of 2024. As we think about this work at Langdon facility, Otter Tail seeks to be a good steward of all the resources that we have in our portfolio. This work is a way to improve our existing generation portfolio fleet, and it increases the energy output at the facility that has performed really well over the last 15 years. We do this by taking advantage, even better advantage, of the great wind resource in northeastern North Dakota to better serve our customers. Langdon is a 27 turbine. It's a 40.5 megawatt facility today, and it'll be a 27 turbine, 40.5 megawatt facility at the repower. with the upgrades at the existing turbines will maximize the useful life of the assets. And by increasing the energy output, which again will benefit customers, but also be a benefit to the state through the increased tax revenue as that energy portion of the property tax revenue. And while we haven't executed yet our contract, but as we see it today, the new blades will be produced in North Dakota, just down the road from the Langdon site, and creating work for that facility where the blades will be manufactured. And then the obsolete blades will be recycled and reused for another purpose as we work through our contracting. The work will be minimally disruptive. It's planned to be completed in areas that were used during the original construction. And at our meeting in Langdon, we met with the Cavalier County Planning and Zoning Commission on March 29th and confirmed that the work falls under our existing conditional use permit. So with that overview, I'll ask Molly to summarize the work to date and the studies and components that are included in our initial filing. And then after that, we'll move in through a little bit more of the components that actually get replaced during the project.
Thank you. So before you have the folders that we submitted, and they have the certification filing that was submitted along with an environmental Exhibit A that has the analysis of the exclusion avoidance areas and some study work that has been completed. The acoustic results, including two of the sound waivers, are included, shadow flicker assessment results, the DNH determination of no hazard numbers are included. A microwave beam path analysis was completed to confirm no interference with microwave beam paths. Cultural resource, a class one, as Bryce said, this is primarily in areas that were surveyed before, is also wholly within the areas that were disturbed before. No new areas will be disturbed. So that's just an update of the class one. And then an anticipated discoveries plan to be implemented in the event that any unanticipated cultural resources or remains are identified. The IPAC resource list is identifying the threatened and endangered species that would be in the county, and there's some agency correspondence. So that was all in the initial filing. We then more recently filed a supplemental filing to provide information. It was determined that initially believed that the project would be using 1.5 megawatt 97 meter blades, or rotor diameter, I always say that wrong, rotor diameter, not blades, half of that would be the blade. Ultimately, the analysis that's being conducted indicates that it might need to use a 1.6 megawatt with 91 meter blades, and that has not yet been determined. Bryce will talk a little bit more about that. But that supplemental filing provides both information for the 91 rotor diameter to confirm that the sound and shadow flicker assessment is still applicable. It provides updated figures that have the setbacks for the 91 rotor diameter. And it also includes an amendment request so that we can remove, there's a megawatt limitation in the transfer order at 40.5. Technically, as Bryce said, this will still be operated with an output of 40.5 at the point of interconnection. But because nameplate will technically be at 1.6, we are asking to have that removed, as that's consistent with what's been done in past repower projects. So that was the most recent filing.
As we move on to describing the equipment upgrades here. The wind turbines are going to be improved. Again, there's 27 of them. They'll be improved through the use of the existing towers and the nacelles by replacing or refurbishing components to support the longer blades. As we look through the bottom list here of the Langdon project, for a facility of this size, this is the target replacement is in Q3 of 2024, and the actual component replacement part of the turbines, we don't have the contract signed yet, but we've been told that it'll take about a 2-month time frame to replace the components there. And of course, there'll be some civil work, and there can be some weather in North Dakota as well in that September-October time frame, but that'd be what we'd expect from a time frame over there. The civil work, again, to be completed before that, and then the construction schedules are still to be set, but we're working through those right now. I'm going to move on to the next slide right away just to show. We've got a illustration here just showing the tower, the nacelle, for those to be familiar with where that's at. The majority of the work happens within the nacelle and the components that get replaced there, and then on the front side, the hub and the blades are what that component gets replaced as well. The expectation is that it'd be about 20% more energy output after this upgrade. And you can see from the diagram here, it's currently at the Langdon facility, it's a 77-meter diameter, and we'll go to all the studies for the shadow and sound have been at 97, which we think may still happen, but again, the filing last week was there's a potential that it would go down to a 91-meter rotor diameter, and we wanted to make sure that was before we came today, in case it could be potentially a smaller impact, but all studies included to date have been at the 97-meter rotor diameters.
And should the rotor diameter be the only thing that should that correspond directly to shadow flicker and noise? It would seem to me that it would correspond probably to shadow flicker. But when it comes to noise, and am I recalling right in the previously filed stuff? Now I'm not comparing to what's currently there, but from the initial proposal, now these are shorter, but actually would produce more energy, except for your interconnection agreement. And so if they are able to produce more energy, they must be quite a bit different. So is there the potential that they make a lot more noise?
From a 97 versus a 91?
Yeah, or any of that compared to what's already been approved in the current.
Sure, yes. Terms. So when the projects were initially constructed, there wasn't a sound. There wasn't a sound standard, and the commission order when originally constructed was a 50 dB limit, which was just generally accepted at that time, and now there's the 45 dB limit, which the sound studies that we performed with Epsilon completed those sound studies for us, and each of the receptors available were able to be in compliance with that 45 dB either through a sound waiver or through noise reducing operations, serrated edges, and those types of things. So we would be in compliance with the 45 that's currently in place.
And your question about the 1.5 versus 1.6, so Epsilon did confirm that the sound profile is the same for the 1.5, 1.6 technology. I think they don't even make the 1.5 technology to date. It's now 1.6, so while it's called a 1.6, it's just that's what the technology is that's available to implement the operational upgrades. So it's more of a technical change than an actual change in operations.
But they will be staying under 45.
They will be, except for those that have waivers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then this next...
One question. The 20% more energy generated annually, is that just a factor of the new blade design? Maybe the longer blades and just better design?
Yeah, so the longer blades is the sweep is longer, so it can generate more. And then the hub replacement, there's this pitch... the pitch drives that are in there that allow for to catch more and operate more frequently.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And so there will be, how does that 20% more energy generated annually come about? Is it just they're operating under more conditions or just more efficiently when they are operating, or both maybe?
I'd say they'd be operating more under more conditions,
okay.
But again, our interconnect agreement is at that 40.5, sure. So it's not that we can just run them as fast as we can. We still have to be under that 40.5 interconnect agreement that we have.
Yeah, but you'll just be you'll be producing that 40.5 more regularly.
Yes, that's right.
So just to clarify that point a little bit finer, so your nameplate would be above the 40.5, so that might actually cause you to curtail in some situations, but in many other situations where you would be under that 40, you would kind of run full bore,
yeah.
Where at some level under that, but it would still be higher than the level you would normally have run. Is that a good characterization?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
You did a better job than I did. Thanks, Victor.
And one more thing, is there any chance of getting your interconnection raised? Is that a big deal for 3 megawatts?
We have visited with our interconnect. Past repower projects in the area have not adjusted the interconnect, and so we haven't intended to go that path due to difficulty with it.
Sure.
So we don't plan to do that at this point.
Got it. All right. Thanks.
Okay. I'm going to go into the component replacement illustration, which I think is interesting to see the inside of the nacelle and what actually gets replaced for it. And Victor thought it was interesting too, so I thought, well, I might as well talk through it then as we share it this afternoon. This shows the hub and inside of the nacelle. Again, and so just going from left to right, the hub, the nose cone or that spinner area, and the pitch drive that's listed there, those components are replaced to accommodate the larger blades. You go across the top, there's a rotor shaft or main bearing that gets replaced. The oil cooler is replaced to work with the new gearbox, and then the gearbox is replaced. There's a coupling moving the gearbox that also gets replaced. That moves over to the generator, and the generator is actually a refurbishment of the existing generator, so that ends up getting refurbished. And the mainframe, or people call it the bed plate or the generator cradle, that's that component that holds the generator, that actually get replaced as well at the repower. And then I think the only other item I want to mention on here is that we have for the bearing bracket, all the bearings get replaced. Those are things that happen in a lot of normal O&M as well throughout the years, but those will be replaced as part of the project as well.
Does this have any impact on the low temperature operational range for the turbine? You know,
yeah.
So I don't know what the current low range temperature is, but does this increase or decrease that at all?
We have an extreme cold weather package currently on them, and that's not expected to change. Okay. But that includes there's extra heaters in there, and then there's more insulation in the nacelle that's there, and that'll be there when the upgrades are done as well.
And I'm not integrally familiar with those cold weather packages, but I think a lot of it is around the oil that's within the the gearbox and that oil cooler mechanism.
Yeah.
That's the primary concern. If it gets too cold, that oil is just too viscous to do proper.
Correct. We need that extreme, call it an extreme cold weather package is what we need.
So is that different than the cold weather package?
The extreme one?
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Because the cold weather package, I think, goes to 20 below. But that is not extreme cold weather. It can get colder.
So I built it up in my mind, but we have to minus 20. And
all right.
I made it extreme unnecessarily and inappropriately.
Okay.
So minus 20 is our cutoff.
All right, good.
And we'll be at repower as well.
The pretty cold weather package.
Fairly pretty.
I have a question. You talk about how you do the blade removal and the, you know, what you do with them, but what do you do with these parts? Do you recycle these parts or?
So for the blades,
the parts that you just went through in here.
In the nacelle.
other than blades.
Do you recycle them?
Oh, for the components, the metal components could be recycled, yes.
Since you're talking about recycling, can you talk a little bit more that where you take the blades for recycling? And you said they grind them up, but tell me more. That's a kind of a hot issue lots of places.
Yes.
What happens to them?
Yes. So we're in the contract negotiations of what will eventually happen to those blades. At this point, the expectation would that they'd be taken off site, ground up, and used as cement for future. But that will likely not be part of our contract, that there's a specific use for it, but that it will be specific that they will be recycled and reused for a different material going forward. So we'd get a certificate of recycling.
Sure.
I think that's the term that's in the contract, or a certificate for recycling once the blades are taken off site to be used for a different
use. Do you know where is that in Minnesota, South Dakota? What state does that? Do you happen to know?
I don't know that.
Iowa. That would make sense. It's a long way to drive those blades.
So they come and get the blades?
Maybe repeat that for the record.
Yes.
Need to speak. Get a microphone, please.
Title would transfer to the vendor once they were removed. And then they would own them and take them off site and recycle them.
Perfect.
I liked how it said in the application, no blades will be deposited in a landfill.
But are they going to be cut up on site to be transferred? I presume you're probably not hauling them on special trucks like you have all blades in.
Right. The contract isn't signed yet, but at this point, the expectation would likely be that they'd be cut down into smaller sections, but that is not defined or specifically agreed to yet. But it makes sense to be able to transport more efficiently that way.
I think it's important to be clear about that, though. We can't just chop these up out there in somebody's field and leave any of the dust and stuff. As I've heard in other conversations, especially with fiberglass, it's a concern what happens with that. It's not like sawing a piece of wood that nobody really cares what happens to the sawdust. And so I think that...
It says in Exhibit A that you'll be cutting them up on site to transportation-sized pieces, but...
So some of the conversations around that as we've worked through contract and moving that along is, and I don't have all the specifics of the work that's done and the water and slurry as you cut those down so that those particles aren't lost. The point is, I understand the point taken. Anything else? If not anything else on that one, then the next slide is just a real basic overview. It shows, and this again, these figures are part of the initial filing as well, but it's a map of the location layout. And just want to show again, the facility has been, has 27 turbines. It's been in operation since 2008. And once the upgrades are complete, the facility will still be a 40.5, or be still operating at the 40.5 megawatt operation. I mean, no change to the generator interconnect, nor to the underground, the substation, or the collections facilities. It'll all be above tower. All the work will be above tower. The next section, we just talk about as from a North Dakota perspective from an investment. At this time, we expect that the blades will be sourced from North Dakota, and so we're happy about that, and like to see that as we move forward with the project. We look at these as the additional energy. There's a megawatt component of the tax, and as well as there's a megawatt hour or the energy produced, so that would increase the taxes paid by the facility. And then the upgrades increase energy produced and reduces costs in the long term just through replacement of these components.
So you mentioned the energy taxes. Are there? I don't think I've recalled ever discussing this in an upgrade project. Like, are the blades and the other components, is there sales tax on that? Is there any other tax revenue that the state experiences with these upgrades?
That's a good question on the components side. Past repower projects, our understanding is that past repower projects have received an exemption for the components or the equipment that comes in. We have not yet sought the exemption, but have visited with the tax office about seeking that for this. So that'll be one that we will request an exemption for those components. So there wouldn't be a sales tax on those if we were granted the exemption.
So just talking again about the filings that have been made. So this meets the requirements under the certification in section 4922.033A of the Century Code. It's wholly within the designated project site. It improves existing energy generation technology as shown in the certification and in the accompanying Exhibit A. It meets the current exclusion and avoidance area requirements. So there are turbine setbacks that are now in place that weren't previously, but it is complying with those. With the one exception of a property line setback, we're requesting a variance and have obtained the necessary signatures for those. We will file those as a condition of the order. We would file those prior to construction for the variance. As sound requirement, it's been designed. There's two waivers in hand. It's been designed so that the remaining, if the waivers are granted, it can be over the 45. If those waivers are not granted, it is at the 45, and that's what's shown in the sound report. So you'll note that there's only two receptors that are currently over 45, one at 48 and one at 49. Those are the two with waivers. Everything else can be operated at 45 if those waivers are not granted. Cultural and wetland avoidance, it is covered also in the certification. Again, this is all in previously disturbed areas, so no new disturbance. And it complies with the commission's prior orders. Yeah. And the amendment request is, again, just to remove the megawatt limitation so it can go from a nameplate perspective above 40.5. It will only be operated at the point of interconnection at 40.5.
Molly, could we go back to the sound
stuff? Sure.
So in the application, I realize some of this might relate to a different turbine, but page 4 of the stuff on the front section. With the upgraded equipment, sound levels were modeled at between 46 and 49 dBA. For 6 occupied residences and then 45 or below for the remaining. So you just said 2 of the residences. So can you explain that distinction?
Sure. So this was the sound modeling before putting any sound limiting technology on. So the trailing noise technology was added to up to, it would be up to 10 turbines that would need it to have meet all of the requirements. So when you look at the sound report in Appendix A, when it gives the results, you'll see that only 2 are above the 45. That's because Otter Tail wanted to make sure that it could meet the 45 requirement even if it did not have the waivers.
Okay. So can you, I had a little bit of a hard time finding the different locations of where those turbines are. Could you show me?
So which ones have the noise trailing technology?
Well, I guess if it's within, if they're compliant with that technology, I probably don't need to know. But the two that you got the waivers that can't meet the 45, even with that technology, where would those be located? What would be the best research for looking at that?
If you look at the sound report, it lists the receptor IDs in the table, table B. And
where
there's
that sound report.
If you in Exhibit A.
Okay, but where? in Exhibit A, because.
Yeah, it's right before the waivers, and then so that map will show you which turbines.
She's got a.
This map.
Is it on the back of that?
Right behind it. Yep, right behind it is the table. There you go. Yep. So there should be a table. Does it say B1.1 and 1.2? And 1.2 is listed by sound.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So Victor's 17. Got it right. So 17 and 18 are the two that have signed waivers. One is a participating landowner, so we provided a portion of the lease that has a sound waiver in it. The other one is a non-participant, HEC is the name, and they signed a separate waiver. Those are right behind those tables.
So why are there so many, this is just another question, but 17S, 17, 17E, 17W, what are those?
Sure. So when they modeled, they wanted to do the 100 feet, within 100 feet, so they chose both a point at the receptor and then a point that was 100 feet in each cardinal direction of the receptor to meet that 100-foot requirement.
Got it.
So that's why you're seeing, yeah. So you've got 17 is at the receptor, and then you've got south, east, west, right. North. If you skip down, they actually go a little bit out of order. So you have the four card. You basically have 5 points for each receptor.
Okay.
And so 17 and 18, there is a map, that one that you're folding out. This map will tell you which ones have the LNTE. It's the ones with the orange that are shown here. And then there's, just make sure I'm looking
at
it correctly.
And the LNTE is that noise reducing?
Low noise trailing edge blades. Okay. And so these results ultimately that are in B are showing with that technology, and that's how we're saying that the other four meet because they're at 45 or below for all of the other receptors.
Okay. Except for 17 and 18, so those would be...
Right, because those we already had in hand, so they went ahead and did the modeling to account for what those would be with those waivers.
And do you have waivers from those others as well?
They're in process, but don't have the waivers for those we do have for the property line, but not yet for the sound.
Okay.
And so if they choose not to sign the waiver, then this will be what is implemented.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were you going to go through some of that property line stuff? Because I didn't have a lot of time, so if it required me to really study it, I was like, I'm just going to ask.
Okay, sure.
Because I couldn't figure out these maps either.
Yeah, so would you like to go through the maps and the figures?
Well, I was particularly confused by this stuff.
So that first overview map. So this is, I'll walk through the chart then that's on. And we're all looking at the first figure in the set of figures that were provided.
So is this on the refiling, or is this in the original file?
I can, whichever one you'd like to go through, I can walk through.
Well, I guess whatever is the most accurate.
I think they're both
they're both accurate. One is giving you the setback distances if it has a 91-meter rotor diameter, which would make it shorter than if it has a 97. So the taller one, if we go through the one that was originally filed, that would be the taller one and would encompass both of them.
Okay, that would be great.
So the chart that's here shows the current PSC standards, and I'm on the first figure. Actually, I should take that back. I'm on the first page of figure 3. So the first figure is the overview. The second figure is our turbine proposed. So that's, yep, if you skip that one. And then if you open that one up.
This one?
Yep, I think.
This is exclusion and avoidance areas?
Yeah, if you open one right before it.
Oh.
There should be, there.
That says figure 1 site overview.
I'm missing a page or something. Something's out of order.
That's it.
That's the one.
Out of topology. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, yeah, that chart.
Yeah, so this chart shows all of the setbacks that were applied. So the current turbine setbacks are listed. And then you'll see in the second half of the table, it's basically the commitments that were made at the time the project was permitted. So we included both sets to show compliance.
No. You've got setback requirement, the first column.
Correct.
Distance measurement, what is that?
So that would be the distance to meet that requirement in meters and in feet. So 1.1 times the turbine height from the nearest edge of an interstate or state road right-of-way, 463.7 feet. And you can see then when we scoot to the right, the closest turbine is turbine 3, and the closest distance to a state right-of-way is 5,892 feet.
Okay, got it.
And so as we move across, they're basically showing what the setback is. The next column is the distance in meter and feet that you would need to be at to meet that setback. The next column shows the closest turbine, and the very last column shows what the distance is between the closest turbine and that feature.
Got it.
So you'll see if all of them are above until you get to the property line, and then we see that there are, the distance is 463.7 feet that you would need to meet, and we have these four turbines that are below. Actually, three, because I guess we left in the one that was the closest, but it is above, so three.
4 feet.
4 feet.
I have a question I've never thought of on this whole setback business.
Okay.
When you look at someone as a non-participating landowner, so a developer comes out and puts up a turbine on a participating landowner's piece of property. 10 years later, that person sells the farm and it gets divided among various neighbors. Now the property that's fairly close is not the same as the owner of the land where the turbine is, and you do an upgrade. Is that still considered participating property because that was the status when the project was developed, or is that looked at as someone else's land now and so they are not a participant?
So if you're talking about the land where the turbine is located, that land...
I'm talking about the neighbor that's close by.
And so now they were never a participant in the project.
But they maybe were. If the same person owned 2/4 of land...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Build it, but now you sold this one. Does that forever kind of get attached as participate? You bought it knowing this thing is close?
Yes. I mean, if it's subject to a lease and that lease, typically those are recorded and move forward, yes, it is subject to the lease that was executed at the time. So, yes.
But the neighbor's land wouldn't have a lease, so now they become a non-participant.
The land would have a the land may still be under lease. It may be owned by somebody else, but it would have been transferred subject to that lease.
I think what she's saying is the parcel itself is what they're defining as correct. Participating. So they're paying for a lease on a parcel of land, whether that parcel has a turbine on it or not.
Yeah.
That's the definition of participating in this context anyway.
If this piece of paper, let's say in your scenario, this piece of paper is split in half. So this is all one at the time it was built. There's a turbine here. This is all subject to a lease. Even if this half gets sold to another person, it's still subject to that lease, so it's still a participating parcel in the property.
If you go to the figure directly before that one, I think it kind of spells it out a little better, too, that actually the area highlighted with the green is indicating participating parcels.
Yeah. That's indicated on this other map, too. It's just harder to see.
Yeah.
It's outlined in green, all of these. So Molly, on these setbacks, what kind of conversation do you have with the landowners? Have you been out negotiating with the whole footprint on this upgrade? How much do people know about this? And especially, I'm assuming since you have some potential impacts on these, you've talked to them.
Yeah, everyone that has needs a waiver has been talked to. The three waivers that are needed for the property line setback are in hand, so we have those. And then the others are in process. I'll say, too, that there was a mailing that went out just as a part of the lease process to provide an updated exhibit to the lease, and that went to all of the landowners. All of the landowners got notice of the project as well. And so there was a contact person identified in that mailing.
Okay.
Bryce, anything that I missed on that? Nope. Go ahead. On the non-participating property lines, those have been obtained. We have them, yes, and we will file copies of those.
And then on the, your 1464 from the occupied residence, the nearest.
Correct. And three times, and that would be a non-participating, so the height is 1264.3 would be three times the tip height at 97. Their 1464 is the closest.
Is that person, I mean, you meet the setback, but are they aware of this? They're a non-participating landowner?
You know, I don't know what non-participating landowners necessarily know. We did meet with Cavalier County about the project, and that was at one of their public meetings, but you know, to Bryce, I don't know that there's been any specific discussion with non-participating.
No, not.
Other than waivers.
Clarify, 25, turbine 25, on that previous commitment section. Is that one coming close to the non-participating landowner? Am I understanding that correctly?
So the setback, to meet the three times tip height, the setback would be 1264.7, and it's 1464. So it's about 200 feet beyond what it needs to be to meet the three times tip height. It also meets the 1400 commitment that was made, 1400 foot commitment to occupied residences that was made previously.
Right.
So it meets both requirements.
By 4 feet.
by 64 feet.
Sorry.
And then, you know, by 200 feet to your current standard. So, which is.
Okay.
So it was the four.
Yep. Got it. All right. Thank you for going through that. And then that's start good. Oops. since I have to leave in like 2 minutes, I just want to double check and make sure we don't have any other questions. On page 3 of the application, and it kind of starts on the previous page, but it says the upgraded project activities will occur primarily within areas previously surveyed for cultural resources. Does that mean, I'm just concerned about the word primarily.
So at the time that this was originally constructed, there was a different methodology for cultural resources than is applied currently. They did not require the entirety of the area to be surveyed. However, because they're staying wholly within areas that were previously disturbed, when Otter Tail's consultants met with and talked with SHPO about this, they agreed that no additional survey work needed to be done unless they have crane paths that go outside of those previously surveyed areas or previously disturbed areas. So, okay. Yeah.
And then are you doing the did they request that you do that architectural study?
Yes. Why? That's a great question.
How much does that cost? I'm just curious.
I don't know that I have that answer. Do you want to?
Yeah, well, we did the one of the architectural with, that was in early March.
Yeah.
Right, and then the expanded one is the one that we still don't quite understand.
We're still working
the need, with them. The need on it, so we're communicating back and forth with SHPO of the actual need for it. And with Langdon, I mean, it'll be in the tens of thousands of dollars to do, which trying to figure out the benefit on it. We do have our eyes set on repowering some other facilities in the other areas that could have even far greater impacts and could be
I mean,
very
I get
expensive.
It on the new project, but when the tower's already up there and a feature on the landscape, I don't know. That might be something we want to get clarification from SHPO on what the value is that they see in requiring those studies. So,
I think that would be helpful.
I don't have any additional questions, I don't think, but I appreciate your good materials.
Thanks. Then maybe I'll just wrap with the request. Then is that we're requesting the approval of the certification of the Langdon Wind equipment upgrade and the amendment request to remove the megawatt limitation in the prior order, and certificate of site compatibility. And thank you very much for the time and letting us be here to talk through the project today.
Did Harvey or Jason have anything to add, or you're in the room, so I assume you would be letting us know if you did.
I have a little bit on Shadow Flicker. Go ahead on the line if you have something.
No, thank you, Commissioner Christian. The only comment I would make, and I didn't want to interrupt because there might be a little bit of a lag, but I did look up the GE Extreme cold weather package. There is actually a cold weather and a cold weather extreme, and the temperatures are negative. It goes all the way to negative 40 Fahrenheit for the extreme cold weather.
That's starting to touch on maybe not extreme cold, but colder than appreciated.
Yes, sir.
So thank you for that, Jason. Appreciate you looking that up.
So just real quick on Shadow Flicker. So it looks like we're well within the guideline of 30 hours per year for expected case. I just wanted to touch real briefly. One of the things that I kind of like to ask for, so it's a nice little summarization that exists on this analysis where it shows the worst case and then the expected case. Are there additional reports available that show the individual days that the Shadow Flicker is expected for each receptor site? It just kind of helps kind of set the stage if we ever have an issue with this down the road.
So we can ask Epsilon if they have that data. I will say that because it is modeling and it's an annual average, those days aren't necessarily accurate as to what will actually occur on that particular day. So,
I agree. Like all of it is parsed down into, you know, assuming wind direction and cloud cover and all those kind of things. Yeah. So the expected, I don't have any reason to challenge that expected case versus the worst case. I was just wanting the modeling analysis generally assumes when it comes up with the worst case, it'll say, okay, from this time, this receptor has the potential for it on these specific days. So it basically has the kind of the finest level of detail of the worst case. Helps in the event that we ever have a problem with shadow flicker. Every now and then, it's not all the time, but every few years we might get one on some wind farm in the state, and it helps figure out where the issue may be.
And I think we gave that kind of, was that the same data we gave for Badger?
Yes.
Okay, I know exactly what you're talking about. So yeah, I'll talk with, we can talk with them see if we can provide that.
If it's possible, I'd appreciate it. If it's going to result in additional study, I'm not going to press for it, but I would like it if it's possible.
We will definitely check and circle back and let you know.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. Mine is more of a curiosity question. When you first built this wind farm, and I know that architectural studies weren't required at that time, when this was being built, if you came across anything, what were the requirements at that time? I'm just curious.
So I to say this project, as far as what was done when it was built, I don't know that we can say what was done when it was built, because I think it was built by...
I guess I'm just saying that if you came across something, building have to halt and report it at that time, or did...
So I can tell you what typically happens. Would that be helpful?
Yes.
Usually there's a...
What were the practices?
Sure. Okay. So there's a difference between architectural and archaeological. So architectural would be like buildings, things above ground that you can see. So you would know that they're present, and typically anything that would affect a building would have to be negotiated with the landowner anyway, and those are typically avoided. It's pretty rare that with a wind project that you would be removing buildings anyway. If it's an archaeological, there's typically an unanticipated discoveries plan or training that similar to that that tells the people that are in the field if they come across, like, bones, for instance, that they know they need to halt the operations and contact, if it's human remains, they're contacting the sheriff, they're contacting others. If there's something that they maybe believe is archaeological that should be looked at further, then they're cordoning it off and making sure it's not disturbed. And then they contact like the Historical Society and have somebody come out to monitor it and determine whether it's anything that needs to be protected or not protected or avoided. So that's the typical practice, at least on most projects. I think we won't be able to speak to what actually happened in the field, because none of us would know exactly what happened at the time, but that's what we would have expected to have been the practice.
This project was acquired by Otter Tail after being built by someone else.
That was around that time. Yep.
Anything else? Okay. Is there any objection to any of the information that has been presented today? And I'm talking about orally or the paperwork being made a part of the record and used in a final determination on the case?
No, there is not. And I just note that we'll provide a proposed order similar to what we did for Border Winds, so for your consideration.
Do you know when you would submit that?
Soon. Next week? Is that
that's
soon enough?
I have no big rush if you have no big rush. So.
Okay. Well, I anticipate it will be next week. I was just thinking, just want to check on the shadow flicker piece first, because we may want to take care of it all at once.
Okay.
That's the only consideration.
Sounds good.
I will tell you, I don't know how big of a hurry you are on, how big of a hurry you're in for an order. Way back when we were scheduling our regular meetings for the year, there's just conflict after conflict in me. Mm. And we have a next commission meeting is 2 weeks from today. And, I mean, once you file your proposed order and you get the other information, I don't know how much time this will take to process, but I will tell you that after that, I think the next commission meeting is into June a ways.
Okay. Well, maybe I can ask this. Would it be all right, since I take it the issuance of the order isn't conditioned on the Shadow Flicker data, so can we just move forward with providing the proposed order so that we can help move this forward and then provide that as it's available?
You certainly can. I couldn't say, like, even if you gave it to me yet this week, I can't guarantee it. It's going to make the May 11th because the next week we have a hearing.
Okay. Even if I make it perfect and not just...
I will certainly try to get it on there if it's okay. Possible. But, it doesn't need to be contingent on receiving that Shadow Flicker stuff whatsoever. But we'll do the best we can to get it on the 11th whenever it is you get us the proposed order. But
okay.
I certainly wouldn't guarantee that.
Okay.
Thank you for that scheduling. I appreciate that.
Thanks. Anything else? Okay, again, I apologize for making everybody later than what it should have been. This informal hearing is closed. Thank you.
Thank you.